Sasuke growled pugnaciously. Aye, maybe you would have. Lucas looked away, back towards the steading. He watched a knot of black figures hurry back to the safety of their hearths.
Have you pups ever wondered why we let them live like this? Why we let them suffer hardship and cruelty?
To make them strong,
Ake said, as if on cue. Lucas laughed.
Pride, he said. We have convinced ourselves that suffering builds character. Suffering builds nothing but walls. We settle for beasts when we could have men. All for pride.
He looked around.
And that's the biggest joke of all, pups. Best you remember that.
Ake frowned.
I don't think it's funny.
No.
Lucas spread his arms.
Pride eats at us, everyone, like a maggot in a wound. Russ was proud, and so too must we be proud, whatever the consequences.
We must endure, we must persevere, we must be worthy,
Ake said stubbornly.
That is the way of it, trickster, else why were any of us chosen?
He struck a tree with the side of his fist.
Because we survived! We were worthy.
Survival is a test of nothing more than endurance. If it were anything else, I would never have been chosen. And yet, I was.
Luck.
Lucas smiled as he spoke. This wasn't the first time they'd had this argument since they were cast out of the Et, nor would it be the last. But at least they were listening. Maybe they had even learned something.
It has ever been thus,
Halvar began. Lucas laughed again, louder this time.
Maybe, but why?
He brought his palms together in a loud crack.
Pride! Down here, mortals suffer for our pride. On other worlds, controlled by other chapters, they live in peace. They don't suffer as we suffer, and yet they produce warriors of equal skill.
He noted the frustration in their faces, the lack of comprehension.
None are greater than the rout,
Dark said. Not angrily, but as if it were no more than simple fact.
We are the Allfather's chosen warriors.
Oh, we like to pretend that we are better, that our savagery makes us strong. But it's a lie, told by old men who were themselves lied to by those who came before. Worst of all, we all know the lie for what it is, but we accept it because to do otherwise is to admit that somewhere along the way we made a mistake.
Lucas grinned.
More than one.
Ake bared his teeth.
And your answer to this revelation is, what, mockery?
Lucas shrugged.
Can you think of a better response?
We are nothing more than the largest, strongest pack of wolves on this frozen mud ball. And that is all we will ever be.
A poor life,
Halvar said,
muddying the glories of others.
Glory is for the dead,
Lucas said.
The living must be reminded of that, so that they don't lose themselves in sagas.
He thumped his chest.
So that we don't become that which we fear most. Beasts, and worse than beasts, following a false scent to our doom.
He pointed to the steading.
That is why I feed them. They are my pack, pups, as you are. Do you see?
Looking at their faces, he knew they did not. Not really. Not yet. But they might. In time, he shrugged and smiled.
Or maybe this is all a lie, a ruse to make my pranks seem more than they are. Maybe I am simply the spiteful jackal wolf, content to rip at the guts of my own pack for my own amusement.
The other one makes for a better saga,
Dog said after a moment. Lucas clapped him companionably on the shoulder.
That's what I tell myself, brother,
he smiled.
Now,
I don't know about you, but I'm hungry again. Let's go find another elk.
He grinned at Ake.
Maybe I'll even let Ake make the kill this time.
Chapter 9. Hunting Grounds. 641.M41. Pinpoint lancefire obliterated the Spinward auger platforms. Their destruction was timed down to the last microsecond to coincide with a solar flare from the system's star. With a gap opened in the auger network, the Sky Serpents entered the Fenris system unnoticed, hidden behind mimic engines and shadow fields. They remained that way as they navigated the tumultuous celestial tides. Sliskus lounged in his command throne on the bridge of the incessant agony, watching the frost-blue marble expand in the forward viewscreen. The world sang to him, luring him on. He longed to experience its pleasures, but other matters needed tending before then. "Prod the beasts," he said to a member of the crew standing attentively nearby. "Let us draw them from their lair." At his command, a second fleet, much smaller than the first, erupted into real space near one of the gigantic semi-mobile star forts that bracketed the world. Swarms of razor-wing jet fighters and void-raven bombers would harass the star fort before quickly withdrawing towards the edge of the system, where the riveled blade waited. The torture-class cruiser was one of the three he had stolen upon his first exile from Kamara. The cruiser and its escorts would make a show of putting up a fight when the system battle fleet responded before drawing the Mon-Ki vessels away. By the time they returned, incessant agony and the rest of his fleet would be safely hidden within the disruptive halo of the system's central sun. From there, he could orchestrate similar raids at the few inhabited planets in the system, keeping the battle fleet occupied while he and his guests enjoyed themselves. The trick wouldn't fool the wolves for long, a few weeks at most, but that was long enough. He reclined in his seat as the first reports came in. Contact was immediate and bloody. He smiled.
"Pleased with yourself?" a feminine voice purred.
Slegg, looming beside his master's command throne, stiffened with a hiss and rose up, his hands on the hilts of his weapons. Sliskus waved the Ophidian back and said,
"Always."
He turned and looked at Lady Malice as she strolled across the command deck alone. No Cabalite guards were allowed here, not even those belonging to his subordinates. She looked around at his assembled captains.
"A motley crew, this, Trevelyath. They aren't even all Comorites."
A mutter ran through them, and not a few angry glares were cast her way, much to Sliskus's amusement. Sliskus smiled.
"Some of them play the part well enough. I don't recall inviting you to the bridge, by the way."
Only a few of his subordinates, the most favoured, had been invited to sit with him as they approached their chosen hunting grounds.
"Oh, Trevelyath, you know I rarely let the lack of an invitation stop me," she said. "If I did, I would never go anywhere at all." "I assumed you would be seeing to your own warriors. How many did you bring?"
Sliskus asked, turning his attentions back to the viewscreen.
"Enough. Your assault bays are full of raiders from more than half a dozen cabals, including mine. Reavers and Venoms as well, all waiting impatiently for the webway portals to open and allow them to spill out over this little world."
She leaned against the back of his throne, her fan fluttering slowly to stir the air about her. Sliskus caught sight of Murta standing nearby. His courtesan waited with Jinkar, attentive to his whims. She stood out even among the gaudy corsairs of his court. Murta was a prize among prizes, and he favoured her with a fond smile. She didn't return it. His smile widened, and he turned back to Malice.
"And your question is..."
She snorted.
"What exactly is your plan, Trevelyath, dear? You were most unforthcoming with the details earlier."
"No one else seems all that bothered."
Malice looked down at him.
"Then they are fools. Worse than fools. They may as well be cattle."
She folded her fan and traced his cheek with it. He battered it aside.
They are simply excited, and why shouldn't they be? This will be a most delightful outing, don't you think? Look at it, Aurelia. Isn't it beautiful? It's a world like any of the thousand others we have plundered. Sliska sighed. You have no soul, Aurelia. She laughed. Oh, but I do, Trevelyan. And I have worked very hard to ensure that it remains right where it is. Part of that is making sure that I ask the right questions when the opportunity presents itself. She stepped back and unfolded her fan. It was almost, but not quite, a challenge. Sliskus pushed himself to his feet and turned to face her. His captains drew back, and he smiled tightly. He could almost smell their uneasiness and the faint tang of anticipation. They were half hoping that she was planning on challenging him. They had hundreds, if not thousands, of successful raids under his aegis, but even so, they chafed, as he had chafed. But they lacked his courage, and so waited for others to make the first move. But Malus wasn't here to challenge him. No, he had known that the moment he saw her among his guests. She had come to him for help. He smiled indulgently and led her towards the tactical display plinth. Chained slaves squatted beneath it, inputting data as it reached their communications implants. With every twitch of their pale, thin fingers, the image of the world and what awaited the revelers there became clearer. Other slaves waited nearby, trembling. They carried his armor, a more utilitarian set than he had worn on Pock. The facets flashed, changing color as he allowed the slaves to dress him. The ridged plates sliced through their palms and fingers as they worked, eliciting soft whimpers of pain. He drank it in with a sigh.
Tell me, Aurelia, how would you go about it?
The entire planet is unstable, Malus murmured, studying the data. Save this single continent.
She expanded the view of the landmass that the humans called Azaheim, as he had known she would.
It makes for interesting hunting, at least.
Sliskus nodded.
We shall require shelter from the storm, obviously, some place from which to conduct our celebrations in a fitting manner.
Ah, there.
He tapped a marker on the map. His words were for Malus's benefit. He had chosen the spot days earlier, after studying all the available information about Fenris gleaned from his library. He had pillaged hundreds of human worlds in his time, and had built quite the collection of tithe reports and data compilations. The Monkee were worthless beasts, but they kept fine records.
An isolated outpost of whatever passes for civilization on this barbaric idyll, far enough from the main hub of the Monkee to avoid notice, but still on relatively solid ground. The storm will interfere with their primitive planetary sensor net, and we can baffle their eyes easily enough.
He smiled, pleased with his own cunning.
We shall nestle among them, and they will not see us until it is too late.
Like a serpent, one might say, Malus said idly.
Sliskus looked at her.
A trifle obvious, Aurelia,
she laughed. But apt.
Sliskus turned away.
Your wit grows dull, my sweet poison tongue. Perhaps you need cleverer partners to help you hone it.
Is that an offer?
Sliskus shrugged, still studying the map.
An offer of what?
Speak plainly, Aurelia, or not at all. All this doublethink fatigues me.
She quirked an eyebrow.
You could return to Komorra. It has been too long since your last visit.
Has Vect forgiven me, then?
Do you care if he has?
Sliskus threw back his head and laughed.
I care nothing for the tyrant, and he cares nothing for me, save when I can be of use to him on some matter or other. Much like you, dear Aurelia.
He peered at her, the light of the hololith making his face look skeletal.
You are not so opaque as you believe, dear heart.
Malus bristled.
And what does that mean?
Is it time, then? Have you at last come to it, the great moment for which you have been preparing since Vect cast you aside so many years ago? Sliska smiled. It was the talk of Camorra at the time. Some thought he might take you as his consort. Not me, though. You are the sun, Aurelia, and he is the moon. Two great bodies moving in eternal opposition. You thrive on it, and I was not surprised when he tossed you over for something more pliable, only that it took him so long. Is that a compliment or an insult, Trevelyath?
A bit of both.
Sliskus stepped back and turned away from the hololithic projector, his hands behind his back.
My question stands, dear one.
Did you accept my invitation hoping to secure my allegiance in whatever internecine conflict you're planning?
And if I did?
Sliskus closed his eyes, savoring the moment. It was an exciting prospect, and not unwelcome. He had been getting bored, whiling away his eternity plundering chattel worlds. He needed a new challenge, something with more meat to it. He looked at her.
Then we will have much to discuss over the cooking fires. We shall hunt an agreement even as we hunt beasts. It will add a more subtle pleasure to the visceral thrills to come.
I don't trust her,
Myrta said, watching Sliskus converse with Malice. She stood on the command deck of the cruiser, close to hand, but far enough away that no one could accuse her of eavesdropping. Slaves bustled about her, eyes downcast, as overseers barked orders. Thorn whips lashed the flesh of any who didn't move fast enough for the overseer's liking, and a pleasing aura of pain and despair hung over everything.
And?
She looked at Jinkar. The homunculus wasn't paying any attention. Instead, he was studying the photonic projection of a genetic sequence floating above his hands. Like Myrta, he stood ready for Sliskus's call, though, unlike her, he didn't seem to care overmuch. He had been distracted since the party. She had seen him in close, if not convivial, conversation with Master Jacques of the Hex. Why Sliskus had invited such a creature, Myrta didn't know, but she guessed it was some suggestion of Jinkar's. Myrta frowned and slashed her blade through the homunculus's projection, scattering the motes of light. Jinkar grunted and glared at her.
How rude!
She might be a problem.
Who? Malice? Perhaps.
Jinkar grinned.
Getting nervous, my lady?
Why should I be nervous, Jinkar?
I'm sure I have no idea.
He leaned towards her, close enough that she could smell the stink of the chemicals he used to preserve himself.
But you seem in need of a confession, so I place myself at your disposal. Speak, and I shall do my best to set your mind at ease.
Myrta snorted.
I have no need of your condescension.
Then why are you bothering me?
Myrta had no answer to his question. At least, not one that wouldn't make her seem weak. He was right. She was nervous. The plan, such as it was a tenuous thing. A nudge here, a suggestion there. Sliskus was immune to traditional methods of manipulation. She couldn't seduce him or tease him. She was his slave, bound to him by rites as old as Shymesh himself. As Lilitu was bound to the void, so too was Myrta bound to Sliskus. Even now, she didn't truly understand why. Some bargain made by those of greater influence in the Lemaean sisterhood. She was payment for services rendered. A not uncommon state of affairs, but one normally rectified with a dab of poison at a time and place of the sister in question's choosing. No sister served the same master for long if the latter proved unsuitable. Ownership came with certain responsibilities, and few archons could manage it for any great length of time. Invariably, they would strike or insult their courtesan, and she would punish them according to the ancient laws of the sisterhood. That had always been the way of it, but Sliskus defied even those traditions. He refused to die. Whether it was due to spite or stubbornness, he refused to release her from her servitude. Until he perished, she was trapped. Jinkar chuckled at her reticence.
Patience, dear lady, patience. All art takes time, and this will be a masterpiece. The serpent impaled on his own hubris.
So you keep saying,
she hissed.
Yet there he sits, intact.
The hunt has not yet begun,
Jinkar protested. Murta considered cutting off one of his hands, just the one, to ease her frustrations. Even so, she was forced to admit that he was right. She was impatient. There was time yet. The augmented warriors of the Monki were dull-witted and slow by Eldar standards, but they were also determined and spiteful opponents. A hunt of this sort was sure to elicit a hostile response from them, especially these particular Monki. The savages in their storm-grey armor were barbarians among barbarians. She had often seen their sort fight in the arenas. They were the inevitable favorites of the masses, eliciting cheers with their fierce displays and crude behavior. Barbarism was often confused with heroism at a sufficient distance. Individually, they were little match for a Comorite warrior, but they traveled in packs. For a moment, she lost herself in a much-cherished fantasy of Sliskus being torn apart by the savage monsters of the blue-grey world below. She would try to protect him, of course, but she would be half a second too slow, an instant too late. Apologies and commiserations, then freedom.
He tells me it was your suggestion.
Murta turned, startled, but hid it beneath a carefully composed expression of elegant boredom. Lady Malice stood behind her, fluttering her bladed fan before her face. The Archon of the Poison Tongue Cabal was taller than Murta and clad more richly.
It was, my lady,
Murta said.
And how did you come by the idea? Such a thing would seem to be beyond the knowledge of one of your sisterhood.
Malice delivered the insult with gentle ease. Murta could tell she had done so intentionally. Malice did everything intentionally.
We are not so provincial as you seem to think, and in any event, I have learned much in my time with the Duke, my lady.
Malice nodded, as if that were the answer she had expected.
I wondered to see one of your sort with him, and so far from the Eternal City, she said. Of course, Sliskus has ever been needful of certain comforts.
Much the same has been said of the tyrant at times,
Murta said.
I wouldn't know.
That isn't what I heard.
It was a low blow and crude, but Murta was in no mood for subtlety.
It is said that Vect cast you out when he grew bored with you.
I left of my own choice, little courtesan, Malice said. Unlike you, I am free to choose my own path in this universe. But you, sadly, are bound by the whims of another.
Malice reached out and took hold of Murta's chin.
And such whims they are. Is it true that he immolated a world because its ruler mispronounced his name?
Murta stepped back, out of reach.
He has burned many worlds and spared many more. His reasons are his own. He rarely shares them.
Malice smiled and folded her fan with a snap. She turned.
No, he is quite close-mouthed. Hard to tell what he's thinking, our serpent.
She glanced back at Murta.
But I suspect you might have some guesses.
Murta stiffened.
I would not presume to do so.
Malice tapped the Lemaean on the chest with her fan.
No? Then maybe your companion will share his own.
She turned to the homunculus.
Your name is Jinkar, is it not?
Murta glared at Jinkar, willing him to silence. The homunculus cleared his throat and cocked his head.
I believe I hear someone screaming my name. If you will excuse me.
He bobbed low in a jerky bow and sidled away. Malice didn't try to stop him.
You came to seek his help,
Murta said. Malice looked at her. Am I so obvious, then?
I am observant,
Murta said. You do not approve.
It is not my place to approve or disapprove, merely to serve his will.
Malice tapped her lips with her fan, her expression speculative. Before she could speak, the sudden appearance of Sliskus interrupted her. Murta made to kneel, but Sliskus waved her to her feet.
Now, now, none of that, my lady. You might be a slave, but you are a queen among slaves. Never forget that.
He brushed a stray hair from her face, his smile unpleasant. She resisted the urge to reach for one of the many blades hidden about her form.
You know what to do?
Of course,
she said.
It would be her duty to clear the way for the rest. The raiders of the Sky Serpents would emerge from the webway somewhere above their target and descend swiftly to take captives and ensure that none escaped to warn anyone of their coming. With the base camp established, the full force of the hunt, led by Sliskus's guests, could safely spread across the world at their leisure. It was a rare thing for a raid to take more than a few hours, but not unknown. In such a case, a central rallying point was invariably set up for the inevitable retreat. Sliskus had chosen the spot himself days earlier, after studying the cartographic scans of the world. That Sliskus was bestowing the honor of establishing the base camp upon her could be taken as a sign of his favor. In reality, she knew that it was because his guests would view it as an insult if any among them was chosen without the agreement of the others. Good, he said. Be wary. I'm given to understand that not all in my service are best pleased by my choice. They see only insult where honor was intended.
She stiffened as the warning sank in. Before she could ask, his smile widened.
Smile, my lady. It is midwinter, after all, a season of red pleasures for master and slave alike.
He stroked her face, the edges of his armored fingers drawing blood. He traced the blood across her cheek and above her eyes like primitive war paint.
Go, and be swift. Be sure.
She nodded stiffly and departed. She felt Malice's eyes on her the entire way. The assault bay was a riot of noise and celebration when she arrived. Half a dozen raiders painted in the subtle colors of the Sky Serpents waited in their berths. The crews of the anti-gravity skiffs drank and crossed blades, challenging one another for the honor of the prow position. Only the best of them could man the weapon that was mounted there, whether it was a dark lance or disintegrator cannon. The rest would have to make do with their splinter rifles and blades. Gantries stretched like a web of iron across the bay, connecting the raiders to refueling and rearming stations. She glanced towards the far end of the cavernous bay, where an immense webway portal hung suspended against the interior of the hull in a web of chains and massive clamps. The dimensional doorway was a barbed edifice of black stone, shot through with veins of pale green. It hummed ominously, and the chains that bound it rattled constantly. When it was activated, the raiders would plunge through and into the webway beyond. That the webway itself would have a pathway to their target was a given. Even so, Murta felt a familiar, vague sense of uneasiness at the thought of traversing the ancient subdimension for even a short amount of time. But she was careful to keep her feelings to herself. For all his seeming impulsiveness, Sliskus had carefully orchestrated this raid, as he had all the others. He had left nothing unaccounted for. Warriors greeted her with ironic cheers as she stalked across the gantries. She was as much a mascot as a war leader. Only Sliskus would see fit to turn command over to a courtesan, and for some among his forces this was simply a sign of his infamous changeability. A point of humor, a great jest. For others, it was a subtler cue. Sliskus was no fool. To bestow such responsibility without regard for capability.
Hold, wench! I did not give you permission to come aboard.
Murta continued to climb the boarding plank of the lead raider, its crew falling silent as their commander strode across the open deck of the anti-gravity skiff with one hand on her sword.
"Did you hear me, courtesan?"
"I heard you, Kakaroth,"
Murta said.
"I simply do not care."
Sliskus's reputation for cunning didn't stop some from challenging her when she was given command. While normally such incidents were postponed until after the conclusion of a successful raid, some corsairs lacked the pragmatism of their Comorite kin. Kakaroth was one such, an exile from some minor craft world, still wearing the armor of her warrior path, though much altered now by whim and circumstance. She wore a cloak of black silk over armor the color of blood, adorned with trophies plucked from the dying, broken spirit stones, orc tusks and the like. And buried among them, her spirit stone winked a dull amber. She strutted to meet Murta.
"So good of you to honor us with your presence, courtesan, though I fear you will find no captain's bed to warm here, only cold steel."
Kakaroth looked around, expectantly. Some among the crew let desultory laughter slip, more to avoid offending her than because she had said something amusing. Kakaroth was not liked, but she was deadly with a blade, and that more than made up for a lack of interpersonal skills. Murta sighed and rested one hand on the pommel of her blade. She had known this was coming. It was inevitable. Though Kakaroth had left her craft world behind, she had brought its foolish prejudices with her. True, she had not served Sliskus long, but ignorance was no excuse.
"How droll. I assure you, Kakaroth, that I would much rather be in bed than here dealing with you. But we are all slaves to our master, and he has commanded me."
There were murmurs at that. Arrogant as they were, few of the corsairs fighting under the flag of the Sky Serpents liked to be reminded that they were servants. It was part of Murta's duty to remind them on occasion. Kakaroth seemed determined to be the latest example.
"You are a slave,"
Kakaroth said. She still wore her tall crested helm, her jasper eyepieces winking in the dim light of the assault bay.
"I am free. More, I have walked the warrior's path for centuries. You, in contrast, have spent most of your time in this life on your back. What do you say to that?"
Murta laughed in her face. Kakaroth cursed and went to draw her blade. Murta was quicker. Assassins had to be quick. They had to seize their moment in the instant it presented itself. Her blade sprang into her hand, its delicate curve wet with a toxin of her own devising. It was slightly acidic to aid the blade's entry.
"I may have spent it on my back, but I assure you it was no less arduous,"
Murta said, sweeping her sword out in a shallow slash. Kakaroth grunted and slid back. The wound wasn't fatal. She had twisted aside at the last moment. Her blade came up, and she lunged with a snarl. Murta blocked the blow, but only just. Kakaroth was strong, but arrogant. It would take time for the poison to work. She decided to stall.
"Why now, Kakaroth? Have you finally lost all patience with our ways? Or did someone put you up to it?"
She laughed.
"You are no more than a petty killer with only a handful of followers. You command only a single raider among dozens. But I have ambition. It should be me leading this assault, courtesan. I am an experienced war leader. I have killed more enemies than you, led more raids. And still he favors you."
Kakaroth lunged. Murta sidestepped gracefully.
"Jealousy, then. Is that all? How pedestrian." "He insults us,"
Kakaroth said. Her voice had a ragged edge to it. The poison was doing its job.
"Putting his doxy in charge of a raid. He is mad."
"Us," she had said. Who did she mean? It might be useful to know if things didn't go as she hoped.
"As are you, for willingly bending knee to him."
Murta swayed aside, avoiding a blow that would have decapitated her.
"I was sold to him. What's your excuse?"
She stepped back and circled the corsair, her blade licking out with almost teasing grace. Karkaroth grew more enraged with every light cut, and centuries of training were washed aside in a murderous frenzy. She had been exiled from her home for good reason. Many, in fact, but the rage was a large part of it.
Perhaps if you had spent more time on your back, you might not be so eager to throw your life away, exile.
Murta lunged, her blade hissing over Karkaroth's shoulder. She could hear the jeers and shouts from the crew. Wagers were flying fast and heavy. The odds were in her favor. Karkaroth wasn't the first to have challenged her, and she wouldn't be the last. The key was to make each death as memorable as possible. Murta lapped at Karkaroth's agony as the poison took hold, eating away at her discipline and coordination. She began to slow, and the strength of her blows faded. Murta caught Karkaroth's blade on her own and stepped close, momentarily trapping her opponent's sword.
"Take off your helmet, sister, and let me kiss you,"
Murta said.
"A moment of pleasure before the end."
Karkaroth hissed and shoved Murta back, slamming her against the rail. The Lamaean twisted aside as the corsair attacked. She reversed her blade and drove it into Karkaroth's side. There was enough toxin left on it to eat a hole in the corsair's armor. The blade slid home, grating against bone. Karkaroth stiffened and tried to move away, but Murta pulled her into a gentle embrace, sawing the sword up through the corsair's abdomen and chest. It was a more merciful death than the poison would have granted her, but the opportunity had been impossible to ignore. Karkaroth shuddered and died, still standing at the rail. Her blood pooled onto the deck. Murta drank in her opponent's final moments. Then, with a sigh, she plucked loose the former craft worlder's spirit stone and tipped the body over the side. She watched it fall to the deck below. Kabalite warriors swooped down to strip the body of anything of value before letting the slaves remove it. Here, unlike in Camorra, there was no way back from death for a corsair.
"And even if there was, you are not worthy of it,"
Murta murmured as she kissed the spirit stone flickering in her hand. She slid the stone into her armor as a keepsake and turned to face the rest of the crew.
"I trust everyone was sufficiently entertained."
"Good.
It's time to go."
She gestured towards the front of the bay, where slaves waited on the gantries above and around the webway portal. At her signal, the portal was activated, flashing with a familiar, eerie aura, and the omnipresent hum increased in volume and resonance. A warning klaxon sounded, and the last of those taking part in the initial raid hurriedly clambered aboard their vessels. Murta watched impatiently as almost a dozen slith glided onto the deck of her raider, clutching their weapons and bobbing their wedge-shaped heads in excitement. They hissed among themselves, seemingly eager for what was to come. Besides Sleg, she didn't trust them. Come to that, she didn't trust Sleg either. Despite that, she couldn't deny that having the Ophidian mercenaries nearby made her feel somewhat better. It wasn't likely that someone would try to take vengeance for Karkaroth's death, especially during a raid, but that didn't mean it was impossible. Someone might have been fond of her, improbable as that was. There was a sound like stone splitting, and the webway portal crackled with emerald energies. Lightning crossed the surface, and the flat plane of stone became like black glass. The surface turned cloudy, and a cold alien wind raced through the bay. Distant thunder rumbled, echoing out from the deep places between the stars. Murta turned and signaled to the helmsman, who gave a shout. The ether sails unfolded with a hollow thump. The repulsor keel blade activated, and the raider rose from its berth as the anchoring clamps released, ready to enter the gateway. She closed her eyes, enjoying the growing impatience of the nearby warriors. For a moment, just a moment, she wondered why she didn't simply commandeer the raider and slip away, deep into the webway. Sliskus wouldn't search for her, of that she was certain. But where would she go? As a slave, she had purpose, at least. Without it, she was nothing. She extended her sword.
"Forward," she said.
The raider slipped from its berth with a fervent moan and dived towards the portal. In its wake came the others, accompanied by Venoms and Jetpikes, the first of many. Sliskus was right. It would be a hunt to remember. Chapter 10. Stories in the Dark. 641.M41. Breath puffed out from between Doug's teeth, forming a warm halo about his narrow skull. The Bloodclaw stalked through the knee-high snows of the forest, following the path laid out before him. It was the easiest thing to do when you didn't know what needed doing. He frowned, trying to recall where he had learned that saying. Vague faces and familiar voices slipped through his mental clutches like melting ice. All he remembered of the boy he had been was the faintest impressions. Vague sensations of hard stone against soft flesh. Heat washing over unprotected skin. The taste of warm mead and the hum of insects. He held tightly to those memories, using them as a whetstone to sharpen himself into something new. He couldn't remember what he had been, and wasn't yet certain of what he would become. He was a ghost of future glories. The thought fled as someone shoved him. Reverie broken, he glanced at Kadir. The tall warrior grinned.
"Pay attention, or you'll lose yourself in the forest."
Dag showed his teeth.
"If it gets me away from Halvar's stink, it's worth it."
Halvar grunted discontentedly.
"My stink, as you call it, is the only thing keeping the night devils from swooping down on us."
He lifted one of his many amulets and shook it.
"You're welcome." "The only devil out here is the jackal wolf,"
Ake snarled, shoving past Halvar.
"And it's already too late to escape him."
Dag ignored his grumbling and searched the trail ahead. Through the swirling snows, he could see Lucas forging the path they followed. It was hard to separate the reality of Lucas from the legend. The longest surviving Bloodclaw, the greatest of them, and the worst, with all that entailed. Dag couldn't help but admire him. Granted, there might be some bias there. When the Kraken dragged him beneath the ice during the hunt in the Underfang, it was Lucas who fished him out. He had been closer to death in that moment than he liked to think. And not a good death, or even an especially worthy one. Being crushed into paste by the rubbery coils of a beast was no sort of ending for his saga, short as it was. Luckily, Lucas had been there to tear him free. He recalled those moments of, not panic, but as close as a warrior of the rout could come. The crushing dark, the breath escaping his straining lungs, forced out of him by the Kraken's strength. And that snapping maw, large enough to devour him whole. The fact that something actually wanted to eat him had been eye-opening, to say the least. It had given him a whole new perspective on things, for a few moments at least. Then a slash of light and a brief glimpse of a grinning face as he struggled to the surface. Dag watched Lucas, trying to see him clearly through the distortion effect of the doppelgangrel pelt he wore. Up close, the oily furs smelled worse than Halvar after a training bout, but Lucas didn't seem to mind. He moved with a rough grace through the snow, face set in a half-grin.
"I can't tell what he's thinking,"
Ake muttered. Dag glanced at his fellow Bloodclaw. Ake's scarred face was pulled tight in a puzzled frown.
"I don't think he knows, either."
Dag tapped the side of his head.
"Too many thoughts. They all get tangled up."
"Something you'll never have to worry about."
Ake looked around, squinting against the icy wind.
"We could be drinking mjord and telling lies. Instead, we're stuck out here in the thrice-damned dark."
"You didn't have to come, you know," Dag growled,
annoyed now.
"You could have stayed in the warm if it was so important to you."
"Are you calling me a coward?"
Ake demanded. Dag was fairly certain he wasn't, but it didn't matter. The kill urge was closer to the surface in Ake than in Dag or the others. Few days went by without him using some pretext to throw a punch at one of his packmates. Dag looked at him. He tried to think of a clever way to avoid what was coming next. Nothing came to mind. He sighed inwardly.
No, he tried.
That's it! I've had enough of you, Skullface!
Arkay turned and crashed into him, bearing him backwards. The two bloodclaws slammed into a frost-covered tree, shaking the snow from its branches. The tree, already weakened by the storm, snapped in half, and they rolled through a hail of broken bark and splinters. Arkay was shorter but stronger. Dag tried to put some distance between them, but Arkay was tenacious. At least he hadn't gone for his weapons this time. They traded blows for a few moments, but there was no joy in it. Arkay was angry, and Dag wasn't in the mood to fight.
Get off me!
He roared, trying to break away. Arkay slugged him, and he pitched backwards, crashing against the ground. Halvar dived at Arkay, trying to catch his arms as he made to rise, but Arkay's blood was up, and he wasn't in the mood to go quietly. He turned, still kneeling, and drove a blow into Halvar's midsection, doubling him over. Einar didn't bother with niceties. He booted Arkay in the face before he could rise. As Arkay flopped back, cursing, Einar snatched up a branch and broke it over his bare head. Even then, Arkay refused to calm himself. He lunged awkwardly for Einar, hands groping for the other Bloodclaw's throat. Kadir intervened then. He caught Arkay by the throat and pivoted, tossing the angry warrior over his hip. Before Arkay could rise, Kadir planted a boot on the back of his head and ground his face into the snow. Arkay flailed, trying to get up. After a few moments, Kadir stepped back and Arkay popped up, spluttering.
You!
He began, clumps of snow sliding from his flushed features. Kadir dropped to his haunches.
Me! You can calm down, or we can keep feeding you snow. It's your choice.
Arkay growled, but looked away. Kadir snorted and helped Dag to his feet.
You shouldn't have provoked him, he said. Just as soon as someone tells me how to avoid doing that.
Dag looked up and saw a string of ice-covered skulls hanging from a branch overhead. The bones clattered in the wind, looking for all the world like they were laughing. Halvar cursed and made a gesture.
Death, Marcus. This is cursed ground.
Dag's fingers instinctively found the necklace of teeth he wore about his neck. All of them had been inscribed with warding sigils to keep Morkai from scenting his soul. Halvar wasn't the only one who found comfort in such things.
So,
Arkay said derisively,
we are beyond death or curses.
Halvar glared at him.
Morkai comes for us all. No warrior escapes him forever. Then why try to ward him off with your superstitious gestures?
Arkay laughed. He spread his arms and turned.
Come and get me, you two-headed bastard!
He slammed his fists against his chest.
Here I am! Try to take me, if you dare!
Dag shook his head and looked up at the skulls. There were others, nailed low on the trunks of almost every tree or hanging from branches. Many of the skulls were marked with runes, warnings mostly. Arkay was still yelling at the storm, despite Halvar's protestations.
I challenge you, Morkai! You hear me?
Out in the dark, something answered him. The howl quavered through the trees, momentarily drowning out the rustling of the bones. Arkay gaped for a moment before grinning in excitement. He threw his head back and howled in response. More howls joined the first, and there was a definite challenge in the sound.
Black manes,
Einar said.
How can you tell?
Dag asked. Einar shrugged.
They say black manes serve Morkai,
Halvar said, his hand dropping to the hilt of his blade. He shot a glare at Arkay.
Perhaps he has decided to answer your challenge, fool.
Good. Let them come. I am ready.
Arkay set himself and made to draw his chain blade.
I doubt that.
Lucas's voice echoed through the trees. Dag turned to see him watching them. The trickster grinned and said,
some of those black manes get as big as a rhino. They've got a bite like an ice shark. Bigger head, you see?
He gestured to his own head for emphasis.
bigger jaw muscles. Their teeth can puncture ceramite if they're in the right mood.
He shrugged.
Or so I hear. Never been stupid enough to challenge one myself.
He reached up and tapped a dangling skull with his wolf claw.
Maybe you know something I don't, Ake.
Maybe I do,
Ake growled, lifting his chin pugnaciously. Lucas's smile widened.
Then by all means, show me.
The howl sounded again, ricocheting through the trees. It seemed to echo from all around them. The storm made it impossible to tell which direction the sound was coming from, or how close its originators were. Darg turned. He thought he had spotted eyes as big as a storm shield blazing in the dark. The wolves might already be on them. For a brief moment, he wished he had kept his helmet on. Sometimes his battle plate's auto-sensors came in handy. The howls grew louder. Halvar had drawn his own blade, as had Kadir.
They probably think we're a rival pack intruding on their territory, Lucas said as he sank to his haunches. They'll be looking to drive us off.
You don't seem worried,
Arke said.
Because I have a wisdom that comes only with experience. I know exactly what to do in this sort of situation.
His grin was feral.
I'm going to run while they're busy eating you.
He rose and moved off through the trees. Ake stared after him, momentarily nonplussed. Suddenly, Einar laughed. The heavy-set blood claw swatted Ake on the shoulder, nearly knocking him from his feet. Then he started after Lucas. Kadir chuckled.
He has the right idea. If you want to fight starving wolves to prove your own strength, go right ahead, Ake. But you'll do it without me.
Halvar sheathed his blade.
You called this doom down. Deal with it yourself.
He turned away, glancing at Darg, who shrugged and followed after his fellow bloodclaws.
Cowards!
Einar made a rude gesture over his shoulder. Darg and the others laughed.
We're a pack!
Ake shouted.
And the pack is leaving, brother!
Kadir called out.
Cowards!
Ake snarled again.
Is that the only word you know? Halvar shouted back.
After a few moments, Darg heard Ake hurrying after them, cursing the entire time. The howls faded after a while. Whether they had left the Blackmane's territory, or the beasts themselves had only been passing through, Lucas didn't know, nor did he care. So long as the wolves kept their distance, he was content to leave them be. The wolves had more right to these forests than they did. And, wonder of wonders, Ake kept his grumbling to himself, for which Lucas was thankful. The Bloodclaw had more courage than brains. He glanced back at the young warrior and chuckled.
He's a fierce one. Too fierce, Kadir said.
He had been quiet for several days, rarely speaking, save when spoken to. Lucas wasn't worried. Kadir was a thinker, unlike the others.
Ake seems to be spoiling for a fight at the best of times.
Lucas shrugged.
The kill urge is strong in him. I feel it too, but not like him.
Kadir shook his head and swiped snow from his shoulder plates.
Where are you leading us, trickster? You said you knew these lands. And I do. Don't you trust me?
No, Kadir said, with a smile. Where are we going? Lucas laughed and pointed.
See for yourself. We're here.
The trees thinned, revealing what looked to be a tumble-down pile of stones. As they drew nearer, it revealed itself to be far larger than it had first appeared. It was half buried in snow and rimed with ice, a heavy, crude archway composed of a long slab balanced atop two others of similar size and mass.
What is this? Kadir asked. It's a barrow, Lucas said, ducking beneath the archway. I can see that. I'm not blind. I'm glad to hear it, Lucas said, as he followed the tight curve of the passageway beyond.
Though it was all but pitch black within, his enhanced senses would have shown him the way easily enough if his memory hadn't.
"Come in. If you'd like to get out of the weather, make yourselves at home."
"I meant, why have you led us here?" Kadir demanded, stooping beneath the archway.
The smell of dry stone and earth greeted Lucas as he went deeper into the barrow. A half turn led him into a wide, sloping chamber. The space was circular in design and built of solidly piled stone beneath its shroud of concealing soil. He stroked the wall. They had built it to last, those ancient folk. Even with the whole world against them, they made sure their resting places would survive where other structures might not.
"Are you sure you're not blind?" Lucas called out.
He leapt up onto one of the flat slabs that occupied the center of the chamber. They were laid out in curious fashion, at wrong angles to one another, as if placed in some haste. Some were mostly sunk beneath the ground, while others rested atop it. All of them were marked with worn runes and pictographs. Barrows, cairns, and tombs of all types dotted the lowlands. All of them were marked with runes, telling the history and deeds of those interred within. Great lords and heroes, for the most part. Though this one, with its markings scoured flat by time and wear, didn't seem to identify the resting place of anyone Lucas had ever heard of.
"Was this a king's grave?" Kadir asked.
Lucas laughed.
"No, not a king, I think. Some reaver lord, maybe, or someone worse. There were runes of binding on the outer walls before they cracked off from age and tectonic stress."
Halvar cast a wary glance around as he entered, muttering beneath his breath.
"Runes of binding are not for the graves of men. Not good ones, at any rate."
"Whoever they were, they're nothing but dust now," Lucas said. "And no worry to the likes of us."
He reclined on a flat rock.
"I have laired here before. The last time Gorison banished me. It's dry enough, and the Jatvians and the other local tribes have avoided it these past few decades, so there's plenty of privacy."
He placed his hands behind his head and lay flat on a slab. Kadir lifted something from among the stones.
"What's this?"
Piles of crude jewelry, ceremonial weapons and armor lay scattered about in the dark, heaped up against the slabs.
"Offerings,"
Lucas murmured, taking the beaded necklace from the Bloodclaw. It was made from bits of gold and polished stones, worth a chieftain's ransom to a mortal. He flicked it back onto a nearby pile and turned. Kadir frowned.
"Offerings? For whom?"
"The dead,"
Arke said disapprovingly.
"This place is cursed,"
Halvar began, but the others pelted him with loose stones and jewelry.
"Well, it is,"
he insisted sullenly.
"Not for us," Lucas said. "For us, it's blessed. Move that stone."
He pointed towards one of the slabs. Einar and Dag did as he ordered, and Arke hissed an oath as the ancient stone shifted and came up from its resting place with a groan.
"Is that Miard?"
Dag whispered, peering around Kadir's shoulder.
"Kegs of it." "Not quite the Miard you're used to,"
Lucas said, as the excited Bloodclaws hauled the steel casks out of their hiding place.
"My own recipe has a bit of a kick."
Arke looked at him suspiciously.
"What kind of kick?"
"Promethium."
Lucas scratched his chin.
"Promethium?"
Einar asked with an unhealthy interest. Kadir tapped one of the casks.
"How many of these caches do you have hidden away in the mountains, trickster?"
Lucas shrugged expansively.
"A few hundred. I make a batch every time I come out here. It helps to pass the time."
Lucas had everything he needed to brew Miod in his battle plate and in his head. It required some effort, to be sure, but he had never been afraid of that.
Granted, the first few batches had almost killed him, but he didn't see any reason to worry the others with that little admission. He had perfected the mix over the hundreds of batches since, and now it was as smooth as a mica dragon's hide. The Bloodlaws rolled the casks out into the middle of the barrow. There were 8 in all, sealed in wood, reinforced with Kraken ichor. Without the ichor, the Mjord would eat through the wood. He had gone through a good many batches before he figured that out. Trial and error, that was the way of it.
"What now?"
Ake asked. He gestured to the kegs.
"Did you bring us out here just to sit and drink?"
He didn't sound entirely bothered by the prospect. Maybe he was mellowing after all. Lucas smiled. One could only hope.
"We sit, drink, and swap sagas, the way we would if we were in the 8.
Lucas leaned back, his power pack scraping against the stone.
"I thought you might enjoy it."
He swept a hand out.
"Consider the Mjord my apology for getting you banished, if you like."
Ake snorted and sat.
"I would prefer not to have been banished at all."
He reached out and caught up one of the casks, lifting it over his head. He thrust a thumb through the wood, puncturing a neat hole, and opened his mouth to gulp at the pungent, dark liquid that spilled out. Only when his pate was dripping and his hair sodden did he set it down, his thumb plugging the hole. He grinned at Lucas.
"But it's a start."
Lucas laughed, and the others joined in. Soon the Mjord was flowing nicely, and their tongues had been loosened enough to talk. Lucas started things off with an only somewhat exaggerated story about the time he had tricked Beric Thunderfist into eating wolf dung. The others howled their laughter, and he sat back, allowing someone else a turn. That, too, was part of the tradition. One tale apiece, as the drink flowed and the dark pressed close. A tradition begun in ancient days and appropriated by Russ. Another tool to hammer his warriors into shape. A good trick. Sagas shaped them, whether they knew it or not. Gave them something to emulate and hold on to when needed. A good thing, mostly. But sometimes they believed too hard, and in believing were caught fast. It was like the old tale of the magic box and the ice cat. The sagas were a square drawn on the ice with a shaman's stick, and the warriors no wiser than the ice cat who had climbed into something that wasn't there and been trapped to die of starvation. Einar's story was the shortest, a monosyllabic saga of but 10 words, but amusing enough. Ake boasted of his combat prowess, fighting orcs on some hell world. Not an original tale by any means, but told with passion and drunken gesticulation. Darg told the longest story, reciting every twist and turn of a highly embarrassing, if entertaining, situation involving a rogue trader's daughter. Lucas listened to them all, boastful and rueful alike. These were the foundations of sagas to come, stories that would grow in the telling if their tellers survived. By the time Kadir had finished his tale, Lucas had thought of a way to help them do so. As the jeers faded, Darg caught his attention.
"Your turn again, brother."
Lucas sighed.
"Very well."
He upended the cask he held and drained the last of it. He set it aside and hunched forward.
"I will tell you of Fenk's world, a hive world in the Calixus sector. Cities stacked upon cities, rising from the core to the clouds."
Darg whistled.
"It must have been a sight to see."
Lucas grimaced.
"It was a tomb in all but name. The wind was artificial, stirred by great fans, the weak light of the sun captured and reflected through 1 billion solar emitters. The water so processed and polluted, there might as well have been poison."
He spat and rubbed his nose.
"I can still taste it in the back of my throat."
He tapped one of the talons hanging from his shoulder plate.
"An uprising. Xenos influence. Gene stealers turning the downtrodden and luckless from the honest light of the Allfather to a darker faith.
They swarmed through the underhive like vermin, polluting everything they touched with foul markings and the bitter stink of their alien masters. We came at the behest of the world's masters, and we killed for them.
The Bloodclaws were hanging on his every word. They had all seen their share of war, but they were greedy for tales of bloodshed and glory. Lucas watched their faces and wondered if he had ever worn such an expression. He doubted it.
My pack was to move forward, to take a position, to hold it until reinforced. But the others wanted to attack, to go on the offensive. That was the proper way of it. The enemy were fleeing, broken, easy meat.
Lucas frowned, remembering.
We gave in to our kill urge and paid for it. They led us into an ambush. Xenos monsters came pouring out of the dark, and we fought them.
He traced old marks on his battle plate, grisly gouges made by the talons of things that could rend ceramite as easily as paper.
I learned then that the proper way was not always the right way.
He trailed off. He had heard something. A faint sound far away, but drawing closer. A hum that caused the roots of his teeth to itch. He looked at the others and saw that he wasn't the only one who had detected it.
You heard?
He began.
Vehicles,
Arke grunted.
And not Adeptus Astartes.
Lucas was on his feet an instant later, racing for the entryway.
Chapter 11. Varagir. 641.M41. Heather, shield maiden of the Jatvian tribe, ran through the gloom, her broken sword heavy in her aching hand. The forest seemed darker now, even given the season, and the trees clutched at her. Rain fell in thick sheets, the ice with it, and the ground shook underfoot, making it hard to stay upright. She blinked the cold from her eyes, trying to stay focused on the patch of shadow ahead. She could hear the others running with her, panting heavily. They could not allow themselves to be separated.
"Keep going! The barrow is close!"
she shouted, fighting to be heard over the storm, her voice harsh with fear and exhaustion.
"We'll find shelter there!"
Grunts of assent reached her ears. They were too tired, too frightened to argue with her. Good. It was the only way they were going to survive the night. The barrow was forbidden to them. It was the haunt of fell spirits, and on many a night laughter and howling had been heard emanating from its depths. Whoever slept there did not do so peacefully. But they had no other choice. They were being chased by worse things than ghosts. The Sviatalfa, the night devils, rode the storm winds, and no steel could stay them, no prayer could ward them away. They had found that out the hard way. The creatures had already taken Floki and Asgir. If she strained, she could still hear them screaming somewhere up above the trees. They would not die soon. That sent a chill worse than the wind through her, and she tightened her grip on her broken blade. There was blood on it, though she wasn't certain that it belonged to one of the night devils. Things had become confused in those final moments. Men screaming, hacking at the shadows as their torches were doused by the wind. Bodies falling into the snow or being dragged backwards into the dark by unseen hands. And above it all, the laughter. She had cut herself a path to freedom, striking at anything that sought to hinder her. Her sword had struck something, or been struck, and snapped in two, even as she stumbled free of the melee. Despite the damage to it, no thought of discarding the weapon passed through her mind. It was one of the few iron blades her tribe possessed, bought at no small cost from the Isle of the Ironmasters many hundreds of winters ago, before the tribe had found their way to Azaheim by the will of the gods. She had grown to womanhood listening to her grandfather's stories of Fire Mountain and the great belching metal vessels that had greeted her ancestors' dragon ships. She had hoped to see that strange island for herself one day, but that had been before the fire in the east and the screams in the night, before the Sviatalfa. She could hear their great spectral vessel riding the winds, like a dragon ship, but crewed by unseen demons and growling like a wounded wolf. It skimmed across the treetops despite the weather,
The night devils clung to it, their cruel blades bared, and their pale faces twisted in monstrous glee. She shuddered, remembering those smiles. Heather had faced trolls and drakes, aye, and men as well, cruel men and wild ones, but none of those had been filled with such unholy mirth as they went about their business. Such malice could not be fought. It could not be reasoned with. It could only be fled from, though the thought of it twisted within her. The tribe needed to be warned. They had to abandon this land and seek the sea. Surely the night devils would not follow them. That thought alone kept her moving, despite the growing numbness in her limbs and the ache in her chest. They had to escape, to bring word. Some of them must make it back to their steading. If not her, then one of the others. The thought died in a scream as something rose up beneath her. A grip like iron caught at her and dragged her swiftly down to where a drift of snow had formed against the trunk of a tree. She struggled, but couldn't break the grip. She tried to yell a warning to the others, but a wide, flat palm covered her mouth, stifling her calls.
"Shh, sister,"
her captor growled in the common dialect of the tribes. The hand pressed over her mouth covered almost the whole of her lower face. She could feel his enormity and the terrible strength in that grip. She smelled sour meat and weapon oil.
"Quiet, little one. If you scream, the trick will be ruined."
She squirmed in her captor's grip, and he pulled his hand away from her mouth.
"I will not scream," she hissed. "Are you a troll?"
A sound vibrated through her back, shaking her to her bones. It took her a moment to realize that it was a low, basso chuckle.
"Do I look like a troll?"
"You smell like one."
"That would be Halva. Wave, Halva."
Something twitched in the dark, and Heather swallowed. She and the others had run right through these beings without spotting them. They crouched in the snow, as still as the loose stones that littered the ground. She caught glimpses of the others, held like herself, their faces white with fear. Squinting, she made out patches of grey, pale against the dark.
"You're steading,"
her captor said, his voice unsettlingly close to her ear.
"Has it been attacked? Is that why you're running?"
"No,"
she said, her voice cracking.
"But something is in the forest. It took our people, carried them away, laughing."
Never heard of a troll that laughed."
Her captor leaned down, and she caught a glimpse of a fiery beard and thick braids the same color as her own roughly cropped hair. Yellow eyes flashed. She knew those eyes. Every son and daughter of her tribe did.
"Faragir,"
she whispered. Her captor laughed softly.
"Aye, that we are, little one. The wolves that walk the stars in the flesh. You know us. May we know you?"
Heather.
"Hello, Heather. I am called Lucas,"
he sniffed.
"Jotvian, are you?"
Yes,
she said. Of course he would know. The gods knew everything, especially this god, if he was the one she thought he was.
"Why are you out in the woods, Heather?"
We came looking for our lost people."
"Did you find them?"
"Yes,"
she gasped, trying not to remember. She squeezed her eyes shut, but that didn't block out the echoes of the screams. Lucas's grip on her shifted, his arm tight about her. It was a comfort rather than a binding.
"Easy," he murmured, and she felt the word rumble through her. "Easy as it goes. Tears will come later. For now, I must know how many, what they looked like, how close."
Hesitantly at first, but with growing satisfaction, Heather began to speak. The Varagir had come, and soon it would be the Svyatalfar who screamed. From where he crouched, half sunk in the snow, Kadir listened silently as the woman spoke. Her words came in a rush, one tumbling over the next. He could smell her fear, sharp and sour. He studied her. She wasn't some milk-pale daughter of the southern sea, but a woman of the tiger, raw-boned, with skin burned brown by the intemperate weather. Her hair, raggedly shorn, was as red as Lucas's own, and her eyes were a dark amber, like dollops of melted gold. And there was something in her face, a certain leanness, not the result of privation. He glanced at Lucas and saw a similar leanness there. He restrained a grin of understanding. Of course. He wondered how many generations had passed since Lucas had last visited the Jatvians for longer than it took to drop off a deer. As she finished her tale, he met Lucas's gaze.
Well, what are they, then? Not trolls? No, worse than that. Eldar.
Kadir blinked.
Eldar? Here?
He had never faced that breed of Xenos before.
Corsairs, Lucas growled.
Nearby, Halvar made a gesture of warning. A moment later, Kadir heard the low hum of an anti-gravity engine piercing the storm. And something else. Laughter. Kadir felt his hackles stiffen at the sound. It was shrill to his ears and full of malice. An unhealthy sound that scraped against his hearing. It sent a wave of revulsion roiling through him.
If we can hear them, that means they're flying low, Lucas muttered. Good. Makes things easier.
He looked at the woman.
I need you to scream, Hitha, of the Jatvian tribe, as if you were hurt. Can you do that?
Kadir caught Lucas by the shoulder.
Are you certain of this plan, Strifson? We don't know how many there are. Well, I guess we'll find out, won't we?
Lucas bared his teeth in a wide grin.
If I'm wrong, feel free to point it out, pup. Oh, I will. Be sure of that,
Kadir growled. Hitha pushed away from Lucas. Her fear was apparent, but it didn't stop her. She moved quickly, rising to her feet and running away from them at an angle. She shouted and screamed as she ran, doing a good impression of a woman out of her mind with panic. Of course, that probably wasn't far from the truth. The hum of the engine grew louder as the keen hearing of the hunters caught the screams of their prey. Trees were forced aside, reduced to broken husks by the armored prow of the Xenos skiff. The broken bodies of mortals had been impaled on the narrow butcher's hooks or ensnared in barbed chains and left to bleed out along the curved ridges of the hull. Wild laughter slipped through the air, and Kadir could see thin shapes clinging to the hull or crouched on the deck. Eldar. Just as Hitha had described them. They looked fragile, but he knew better than to take such creatures at face value. Halvar and the others had released Hitha's companions. Hopefully, the mortals would have enough sense to stay out of sight. The blood claws readied themselves, their eagerness palpable. Kadir gestured, and Arke nodded. They would have to be quick. Lucas and Kadir rose up out of the snow as the skiff slid past, anti-gravity generators humming. Softly, quietly, they padded towards it. The crew were too busy looking for their prey to notice Kadir catching hold of the side. The raider bobbed slightly as he hauled himself up with one hand, the other wrapped tightly about his chain blade. The Eldar saw nothing, heard nothing, until it was too late. Kadir leapt over the rail, and his blade struck the steersman in the head. The teeth of the blade growled, tearing through armor and flesh with ease. The alien died in a burst of gore. As its grip on the tiller slackened, the vehicle began to list. Kadir drew his bolt pistol and put a shot through the chest of the Eldar in the fanciest armor. The creature flew backwards and over the rail. He kept shooting until the weapon clunked empty and he was forced to holster it. Eldar rushed him, trying to retake the controls before the raider crashed. Kadir held his ground. The first Xenos to reach him moved with a lethal grace, and its serrated blade carved gouges in the plates of his armor. It struck him twice before he realized it, and the Eldar leapt back gracefully from his counterstroke.
Splinter shots sparked off his armor as its fellows tried to divert his attention. They scrambled along the railing, seeking to surround him. Kadir howled and slashed at his opponent. Chainblade met Xenos' steel with a grinding shriek. The creature was stronger than he had expected, and for a moment it held him back. Its face was exposed, a pale, thin mask twisted in an inhuman snarl. Walls of ink marked its flesh, and its teeth were capped with red metal. Kadir forced the blades aside and drove his head into the Eldar's. Bone crunched and blood sprayed his features as the impromptu headbutt crushed its skull. As the body fell, he turned and swept the legs out from under as Xenos crouched on the rail. His chainblade severed the creature's limbs at the knee, and the Eldar tumbled, howling, into the forest. He ducked his head as more splinter fire cascaded over him. Kadir chopped through the barrel of a rifle, reversed his blade, and drove the weighted ferrule into the chest of the Eldar wielding the gun. Its armor crunched gratifyingly, and the creature fell, twitching. As he stepped over it, something gray clambered over the edge of the prow rail. Several Eldar turned, but too late. A plasma shot erased the head of one, and a second fell with its torso torn open. Lucas grinned at him.
"Well done, pup!"
He dragged an Eldar to its feet.
"See? Even he is impressed."
The Xenos hissed something that might have been a curse, and tried to stab him with a curved knife produced as if from thin air. Lucas lifted it easily and tossed it over the rail.
"Maybe not."
The skiff was making a strange sound. Its hull scraped against the trees, and it began to list even further. Without someone to steer it, it was at the mercy of momentum and circumstance. Kadir staggered as the prow dipped sharply, striking the ground. The skiff shuddered, and something within it exploded. Flames shot across its hull as it shook and tumbled through the air, striking trees and the ground like a child's toy. Without waiting for Lucas, he leapt from the dying vessel. He struck the ground, but a moment later rolled awkwardly to his feet, his armor's servos groaning. He didn't see Lucas anywhere. The skiff struck a rocky scree, and flames blazed up, bright against the snow. The surviving Eldar were rising to their feet as well. Fewer of them had died in the crash than he had hoped.
"Take them!"
Kadir bellowed. They were practiced killers, and moving already. His chainblade thudded down, narrowly missing his chosen opponent. The Xenos moved like black lightning, whirling and slashing with the curved blade it wielded. Kadir found himself disarmed in a moment, the blade spinning from his hands to embed itself in the ice nearby. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw Ake and the others fall on the Eldar, bursting from the snow to pounce on their disorientated prey. Kadir fell back, absorbing the blows on the ceramite plates that protected his forearms. He grunted at the force of the Eldar's attack. It laughed harshly as it pressed its assault. It must have thought him helpless, because he lacked weapons. Its blade skidded forward, drawing fat sparks from the ceramite. At the last moment, he thrust his arm up and away, smacking the weapon aside. Before the Eldar could recover, he lunged. His free hand caught it in the throat, and its armor crumpled in his grip. It clawed for the pistol weapon on its hip, hissing curses. Kadir snapped its neck before it could draw the weapon. He tossed the body aside and turned to retrieve his blade. As he wrenched the weapon free of the ground, a shot glanced off his shoulder plate. He spun, slinging his blade like a discus. It bisected the alien warrior before clattering off a nearby tree. Kadir cursed and hurried to reclaim it. The whine of the engines was growing louder. Lucas's trick had been loud, and the plume of fire lit up the night for leagues in every direction. He could hear the others cursing and fighting. As he snatched up his blade, a smaller vehicle, a bulky jet bike with several Eldar perched on its hull, shot into view. Its weapon spat, and he lunged behind a tree. The jet bike slewed past, its pilot skillfully manipulating the controls to avoid slamming into the trees. As Kadir hurtled away, its weapon chewed the ground in his wake. The vehicle sped after him at breakneck speed, easily sweeping past him.
As it did so, one of the Xenos clinging to its side loosed a loop of barbed chains hooked to the jetbike's hull. The coil caught Kadir's armor, and he staggered. He managed to retain his footing for a moment, but the snow crumbled underfoot, and he was yanked off his feet despite the weight of his armor. He slammed into a tree, and then another. His teeth rattled in his jaws, and his bones quivered with each impact. Desperate, he blindly whipped out his blade. It bit deep into the trunk of a tree, and Kadir held tight to it, trying to pull himself free of the chains. The jet bike plunged on, the chain playing out until it hauled taut. There was an echoing shriek of abused metal. Kadir felt himself losing his grip on his chain blade, and with a roar he caught hold of the chain and twisted, trying to buy himself some leverage. The tree creaked as his weapon began to work itself free, chewing the bark to pulp. There was a flash, and Kadir whipped around, suddenly free. He crashed into the tree and tumbled to the ground, his blade landing beside him. He saw Lucas racing towards him, smoking plasma pistol in one hand. The trickster veered away as the jet bike sped to intercept him. Its splinter cannon fired, shredding trees. As it shot past Kadir, he shoved himself to his feet and caught the broken length of chain. He quickly looped it around a tree. It pulled tight, and the jet bike shuddered. Its engines moaned like a lost soul, and several of the Eldar leapt off as the pilot fought to keep the vehicle steady. The one standing on the rear platform attempted to spin the splinter cannon around to fire at the chain. Lucas tackled the Eldar off the firing platform. The ones who had already dropped to the ground moved to attack the trickster, but Kadir reached them first. As he blocked a blow, he saw Lucas grasp a dark Eldar by the ankle and sling the squalling Xenos into a tree. Kadir dispatched another one with brutal efficiency, his blade whipping out in a tight, roaring arc to crunch through its thin frame and send it tumbling to the ground, broken. He ducked as the chain snapped at last. The broken end caught the remaining Eldar in the head, killing it instantly. That left only the pilot. Flames washed across the jetbike's canopy as it tried to shoot away, engulfing the screaming Xenos. The vehicle crashed and slid, scattering burning debris to mark its trail. Einar stepped past the wreckage, the light casting bands of shadow across his helmet.
"Alive!"
he called.
"If I wasn't, I wouldn't ache this much,"
Kadir said, rotating his arm. Something had pulled loose inside him. He could feel a stiffness that hadn't been there before. He would heal, thankfully. He looked down at the bodies and spat.
"Xenos, filth!"
"Eldar,"
Lucas said. His armor, like Kadir's, was streaked with blood.
"That's what I said,"
Kadir growled, kicking a body onto its back.
"What is it doing here? This is Fenris, not some backwater frontier world."
"Hunting," Lucas said.
Kadir and Einar followed him through the trees, back towards the downed raider. Arke and the others stood around it, their weapons wet with blood. The Eldar were dead. Heather and her companions huddled nearby, staring at the bodies, as if not quite believing that the creatures were no longer a threat.
"I know this breed. They drink suffering as we drink mjod,"
Lucas said softly, staring at the bodies on the burning hull. For once, he wasn't smiling. None of them were. The kill urge was gone from them as quickly as it had come. Lucas began to remove the pitiful remnants from the hull, avoiding the flames that still licked at the crumpled metal from within. He did so with more care than Kadir had ever known him to display, and he moved to follow suit.
"Why waste time on the dead?"
Arke spat.
"This filth didn't come here alone."
Lucas turned, a body cradled in his arms.
"We waste the time because someone must," he growled, low and fierce. "Fenris is ours, pup, and we are responsible for it. Responsible for them. These have suffered twice over what you or I did when we endured the tests of Morkai."
His voice rose to a snarl.
"They have earned your respect!"
Kadir glanced at the woman, Heather. She trembled, staring at the bodies. She was born of Fenris, and so did not flinch from death. But this wasn't death. It was agony. The monsters of the sea and ice didn't normally torment their prey. He looked at Lucas. Arke is right. There will be more of them somewhere.
I know, Lucas said. Which is why we need to alert the Et.
He smiled at the expression on Kadir's face.
What? You thought I would insist on hunting them myself? I might be the oldest blood claw in the rout, brother, but I am not an idiot. Grimblood and the other Jarls must know of this. Fenris must be defended.
Kadir shook his head.
We have been banished, remember?
Lucas snorted.
And so? I come and go as I please. I know ways into the mountain that no one else does. Secret, swift routes. Forgotten roads. All easy enough to reach, if you have the wit.
He tapped the side of his head.
Still, we will need proof.
He looked at Heather.
You will return to your tribe, little one. We will rouse the wolves.
My people,
she began hesitantly,
will be safe. Won't they, Kadir?
Kadir looked at him, puzzled.
What? You and the others will escort these mortals back to their tribe. Then you will watch over them, guard them. I'll take Halvar with me.
Lucas turned to Heather.
Send runners to the closest tribes, even those you're at war with. Most will have already moved to escape the rising sea, but some won't. Alert them.
He looked at Kadir and the others.
You will accompany the runners. I want the tribes aware of what lurks in the night. And if they don't listen?
Kadir asked.
Be persuasive.
Lucas's grin was wide and savage.
Grimblood thought he was going to have an easy time of it with us gone. I can't wait to see the look on his face when we dump these bodies in his lap.
Chapter 12. Cross Purposes. 641.M41. The great beasts ran across the ice. Growths of abnormal muscles stretched across twisted lupine frames, lending strength and an exceptional grace. They ploughed through the curtain of icy rain, leaping heavily over the splintering dunes of ice. In places, the white expanse had been ruptured by tectonic pressures or falling meteors. The ice bucked and cracked beneath their massive paws, throwing up typhoons of freezing water. But they didn't slow, and their howls split the air. The Dark Eldar raider coursed in their wake, following close behind the fleeing pack. The occasional shot from her splinter cannon served to keep the beast from scattering into the storm. The vessel's anti-gravity fields kept the worst of the weather off its passengers and crew, though the craft couldn't avoid being buffeted by the high winds.
And they were once monkey, you say?
Malice asked, mildly interested in the loping beasts.
How intriguing! Some sort of failed attempt at flesh-crafting?
Genetic, if Jinkar is to be believed, Sliska said, sipping from his goblet. They sat together at a table at the prow of the raider. Slaves waited on them attentively, several holding a weather screen aloft.
What you see before you is the result of the primitive alchemy the Mon-Ki insist on referring to as science. They take men and make them monsters. But not on purpose.
No, Sliska said, with an air of incredulity.
Can you imagine?
Quite well. You have seen what the humans are capable of when left to their own devices. Fiendishly clever little apes.
Yes, some more than others.
Sliskus had bargained with and butchered humans enough to know that they had a certain cunning. Not equal to his own, but easily exceeding that of many noble archons of his acquaintance. Still, cunning or not, they were nothing more than prey. He looked out over the rail, watching the beasts flee before him. Two other raiders kept pace with his own, their anti-gravity engines carrying them silently across the ice. Their crews shouted and cheered, eager to make the kill. Jinkar was aboard one with his racks, while Murtagh commanded the other. He smiled at the thought of the latter. Like Malice, she was a clever woman. Too clever, too sharp. She had been forced to kill a number of rivals since they had started the festivities. Occasionally, one of his captains took umbrage at being ordered about by one they took to be a mere servant. Despite the deaths, the hunt was going well. The storm made for ideal cover and added a certain thrill to the aerial pursuits of the Reavers and Hellions. Watching them smash into one another or be blown into a looming crag proved to be of modest entertainment. The primitive humans who occupied many of the semi-stable landmasses made for a good sport. Such brutes rarely had the wit to flee, and instead tried to fight. Such bravery often led to a bounty of fear, pain, and despair. His guests attacked night by night, never for long, and only taking what plunder they could easily carry. Some, like Archon Thindrak, were more particular about what they sought. She and others had focused their efforts on the scattered training camps of the Space Marines that dotted the foothills and valleys of the main continental landmass. These aspirants, they were called, made for deadly sport. Thindrak had some notion of capturing as many as possible for her arenas. Sliskus wished her well, but had little interest in risking so much for so little gain. He had no need of such imperfect meat when hardier fare was close to hand. He leaned forward, watching as his prey ran themselves to death. The wolf things were beautiful in their way. The epitome of function over form. That such creatures had come to exist by accident only proved the malign indifference of the universe. They would find life more satisfying by far in his gardens. If they survived the next few moments, at least.
How long do you think before someone makes a mess of this wonderful outing of yours?
Malice gestured towards one of the nearby raiders with her fan.
A few more days, at least.
You don't seem concerned.
Why should I be?
Sliskus laughed.
We will be long gone by the time our hosts realize the scale of what they face.
He shook his head.
This is not an invasion. It is a raid. There is no goal here save indulgence. We will hunt and enjoy ourselves for what time we can. Then you will return to the stultifying safety of the Dark City, there to lose yourselves in lesser pleasures.
Is that truly how you see the city of your birth, Trevelyath? As a cage?
Sliskus sighed.
Do you know why I left Camorra the first time, Aurelia? I know the rumors that fly about like gloom wings wherever Archons gather. Some say that you were one of Vect's bastards, and that when you learned the truth he tried to have you killed. Others that you are the last of the old Eldari bloodlines, and that you left to rebuild the Empire, one realm at a time.
And what do you say, my dear?
Malice paused.
You were bored. Tired of the same games on the same board. We play them so often that the moves and gambits have become instinct.
Sliskus nodded.
Vect rules because the rest of you are so obsessed with the game that you cannot see beyond the board. You cannot see that the only way to win is simply not to play.
He gave an elegant shrug.
You are right, of course. I was bored. Nothing more. I'm surprised Vect never came after you.
Why would he?
Sliskus smiled, and Malice laughed.
Ha ha! That clears that up. It's true, then. Those ships of yours weren't stolen, were they? Vect gave them to you.
Sliskus grinned.
Say, rather, he let me steal them. And how many upstarts like Zomil have you tweaked and later butchered?
Sliskus didn't reply. He could almost see the wheels turning in her head. This was always the part he enjoyed the most, that moment of revelation as they realized just how cunning he truly was. But, as ever, Malice was full of surprises. Rather than the obvious question, she simply asked, "And now?"
"Now what?"
"Are you bored again? It has been several centuries, Trevelyath, dear. Enough time that even you might once more long for the shadows of Cumorah." "And why would you be interested in that?" Malice fluttered her fan.
"Suppose I were to offer you the chance to once again enjoy the largesse of the Eternal City."
"At your side," Sliska said.
"Where better?"
"That depends entirely on the situation."
Sliskus leaned forward. "You would not be here if you did not need me. Ergo, I have the advantage."
He dipped his finger in the goblet. Delicately sucking the liquid from his digit, he continued,
"One thing I have learned in my time as a corsair is to always exploit every advantage to the fullest."
Malice sat back.
"I'm not the only one who has sought your aid, am I? How many of them, Trevelyath?"
"Why, all of them, my dear. Every single guest, save those I killed, obviously. They all want something from me. That's why they came."
"Obviously. I simply assumed you would know better than to align yourself with such lesser lights."
She frowned.
"Though you never have been what one could call sensible."
Sliskus laughed.
"Oh, you wrong me, Aurelia. You really do."
He turned in his seat, looking at the captives who hung from agonizer racks mounted on the deck. The racks were an invention of Jinkar's, thin frames to which captives could be manacled and then wired into a multiplicity of pain amplifiers, tox injectors, and chem pumps. A handful of native Fenrisians hung from them, their bodies marked by bloody welts and bruises. Their moans had dwindled to silence, and he frowned speculatively.
"Is that why you held this little party, then? To tease your many suitors?"
Malice paused.
"Or perhaps as a way to winnow out those who might prove a danger to Azdrubal?"
Sliska stood, drawing a knife from his sash. Malice tensed, but Sliskus had eyes only for the captives.
"No, merely to exploit every advantage," he said simply. "You are right, of course. I am bored, but that doesn't make me a fool, Aurelia. I'm no revolutionary. Vect is a fine enough tyrant, and I'm quite content to leave his narrow posterior firmly affixed to his garish throne. Why should I trouble myself when he no more rules me than I rule him?"
"And the bounty on your head?"
"It is for show, mostly. I doubt he would weep to see me dead, but only the stupid and the ambitious would seek to claim it. By killing them, I aid him in separating the weak from the strong. Indeed, by abetting his tyranny, as I do, I ensure my own freedom from it."
He pointed the knife at her.
"You should take a lesson from that."
"Really?" Malice frowned.
"Now you presume to teach me lessons in subtlety."
Sliskus snorted and turned to the captives.
"I would not presume to teach you anything, my dear."
Flesh parted, and one of the cattle whimpered. Sliskus clucked his tongue.
"Stay still. How am I supposed to finish this stanza if you keep squirming?"
"You owe me," Malice said, as if it were no more than a statement of fact.
"We owe each other nothing, and I have no reason to endanger myself in serving your ends. Were the situation different, I might in fact bow to the yoke of honour."
It was Malice's turn to snort derisively.
"What do you know of honour, Trevelyath?"
He spun. The blade left his hand, and her fan snapped up, trapping it before it reached her face. Malice glared at him.
"You dare!"
she hissed, rising to her feet. She stopped as Slegg and the other Slith tensed visibly, their flat eyes watching her with brute anticipation. The dry rasp of their coils against the deck was as good a warning as the hiss of a blade from its sheath.
"Aurelia! Of course I dare! I am Duke Trevelyath Sliskus. I have danced with demon women on the hulls of dying ships and cut the heart from a true-born prince while his cabal watched. I have tweaked the nose of the tyrant not once, but twice, and got away clean. And do you know why? He favors you, Malice said. Because I serve a purpose, as do you. Do not allow your ambition to blind you to the realities of your situation, Aurelia. You know as well as I that Vect has spared you all these years, not out of affection or fear, but because you have a use.
Before Malice could reply, one of the raider's crew shouted and pointed. Sliskus laughed and strode to the prow, taking a splinter rifle offered up by one of his slaves. The rifle was a thing of jagged beauty, like all of his weapons. Its stock was inlaid with ivory and gold, and the barrel was covered in ornate scrollwork, carved by his own hand. The design had come to him in a dream, and he had endeavored to capture it in metal.
"What is it?"
Malice asked, turning in her seat.
"They have been brought to bay at last."
He lifted the rifle and peered down its length. The wolf beasts had been driven into the lee of a stone cleft rising from the ice. Such minuscule islands marked the frozen seas like tombstones. This one resembled nothing so much as two axe blades of stone thrust into the ice, one beside the other. The other raiders had surged ahead of the pack and cut them off. The wolf things now crouched among the icy rocks, snarling at the sleek vessels that circled them like birds of prey. Sliskus took aim at one of the beasts as it burst from cover and lunged for a gap between the raiders. He fired. The creature gave a mournful howl and tumbled, hindquarters overhead. It slid across the ice, leaving behind a smear of blood.
"Ah! Take us down!"
Sliskus lifted the rifle and grinned, pleased with himself. It was no easy thing to hit a moving target under conditions such as these. The snow was falling more fiercely as the wind picked up. The raider drifted towards the ice, judging slightly, but Sliskus paid it no mind. He and Malice stepped onto the ice a moment later. It crackled softly underfoot as he strode towards the wounded beast. There was still some fight in it, despite the gory wound in its flank. The splinters had torn open its side, and he could see the pale slash of bone within the mangled flesh and muscle. On the rocks, the other beasts had set to howling as his warriors kept them at bay with bursts of splinter fire. The wolf thing was twice his size. It stank of sour blood and spoiled meat. It whined, acidic slaver dripping from its blunt muzzle as it scrabbled to face him. The whine spiraled up into a grating snarl, and the beast heaved itself in his direction. Inhuman muscles bunched and stretched, claws like knife blades cracking the ice. It lunged for him, yellow eyes wide and empty of anything save feral rage. Sliskus laughed and made to fire, but the beast was too quick. It crashed into him and sent him sprawling backwards. The ice cracked threateningly beneath him as he slammed down. The lupine monstrosity snapped at him, and he thrust the length of his rifle between its jagged teeth. He heard yells and saw warriors racing across the ice to his aid.
"Stay back!"
he shouted, shoving the beast away. Its strength was fading as its blood spilled across the ice.
"This is my hunt, my kill!"
Still gripping the rifle in both hands, he got his feet under him and rose. The creature slipped back, growling. With a wrench of its head, the beast pulled the weapon from his grip and hurled it away. Sliskus leapt back. He considered drawing his liquefier pistol, but discarded the idea. Instead, he reached for his swords. The spirit stones pulsed with agitation as he drew them. The wolf thing leapt, roaring. He ducked beneath it and let his blade slide across its belly. It landed in a heap, its paws tangled in its own intestines. It wailed like a dying man and spun quicker than he would have thought possible given its condition. It snapped at him, tearing at his cloak as he danced out of reach. He slashed at its snout, filling its nose with blood. It struggled on, pursuing him, leaving its life on the ice. He darted in and out, flicking his blades across its hairy form, carving it to pieces even as it lunged and grunted. He could hear his warriors cheering as he tortured the beast. They enjoyed such displays. Sliskus preened, stretching the moment of execution, allowing them to drink in the creature's agony. It was just human enough to have some dim grasp of what was happening to it, almost as if the pain were awakening that part of it that had long been lost. Things that might have been words tumbled from its frothing muzzle, lost among the wheezing snarl. Was it pleading with him, cursing him? He couldn't say, and didn't care. Sliskus ended the dance with a skill that left his audience breathless. The lupine monster made a half-hearted lunge, propelled more by stubbornness than strength. Sliskus reversed his blades and thrust them down through the beast's glaring eyes, extinguishing their baleful light forever. The massive engine of meat and savagery went limp, with only a resigned sigh to mark its passing. He extricated his swords with a flourish, casting droplets of blood about him in a dark halo. He bowed low, accepting the enthusiastic applause as his due. Slegg and several of his coilkin slithered to the body, their blades ready to skin and gut the creature. Its altered organs would make for a unique meal, and its hide would make a fine coat. Leaving them to it, Sliskus strode back towards the rocks where the rest of the pack still crouched. Jinkar was waiting for him there.
"Yes, yes, these will do perfectly," the crooked flesh-weaver said, as the remaining beasts were brought to bay by his racks.
His malformed assistants wielded a variety of restraint devices, shock staves, barbed nets, and neuro-chains.
"So much potential, stifled by circumstance. They are almost art in and of themselves."
He studied the snarling, snapping creatures fondly.
"Oh, what wonders I might make of such raw materials."
"And it is wonders I demand, Jinkar. Wonders and horrors such as no other's eyes have witnessed. Unique and without equal."
Sliskus slapped the homunculus on the back, nearly flattening him.
"I want something exceptional to remember this hunt by."
He looked at Jinkar, his gaze calculating.
"Can you do it?"
Jinkar nodded hastily.
"Oh, absolutely, my lord. I shall torture my muse to the utmost in your name."
Sliskus smiled.
"That's what I like to hear. Now, how is your former master getting along? I understand the Hex have acquired their own pets."
Jinkar bobbed his head.
"Oh, yes. Several less developed examples of the altered template. They're still in the throes of genetic transmogrification into the advanced form. Not quite monkey anymore, but not yet transhuman. Their minds are engines of instinct. Easy prey for Jacques and his pain engines."
That Jacques had gone for such prey was not surprising. The Master of Hex had little love of a challenge. Still, Sliskus admired his creativity. Jacques had a way with flesh and bone that few others could match. That was why he had allowed Jinkar to convince him to invite Jacques. That Jinkar was undoubtedly hoping to somehow worm his way back into the coven's good graces was neither here nor there.
"Good. Good," Sliskus said. "So long as everyone is having fun, yes?"
Murta stood on the ice, watching as Jinkar's racks muscled the last of the snarling beasts into the raider's hold. Shock staves crackled as the racks jabbed the creatures into barbed nets and dragged them bodily up the loading planks. Several of Jinkar's slaves were dead, but there were always more where they came from. The beasts were destined for the pits at the base camp. There they would join the many other prisoners taken in the days since the arrival of Sliskus and his guests. She thought of the humans crouched in their stinking cages, awaiting branding and transport to the incessant agony. The beasts would suffer a different fate than the rest of the meat. Sliskus would want to keep them. He did so enjoy his monsters. She frowned slightly. Sliskus was an avid collector of monsters. Slegg and his scaly kin, Jinkar and his racks, the broken collection of cast-offs, turncoats, and lunatics that made up his fleet. Herself, even. There were some among the nobility of the Eternal City who considered her sisterhood an abomination. They thought them a throwback to the old pleasure cults that had supposedly doomed their ancestors to a twilight existence. And perhaps they were right. Myrta pushed the thought aside. She lacked the hedonistic tendencies of many of her sisters. She preferred the poisoner's blade to the courtesan's dance. Perhaps that was why she had been gifted to Sliskus. As punishment. Her jaw tightened, and her fingers gripped the hilt of her sword. A burst of laughter caught her attention, and she glanced at a nearby knot of corsairs. They were dressed in colourful silks and armour that was more decorative than functional. They were watching her, and she had little doubt that their laughter was directed at her. She drew her splinter pistol smoothly and fired. Ice cracked and sprayed across their armour. They leapt back, their jeers turning to cries of alarm. She smiled prettily and holstered her weapon. They turned away from her, pulling the tatters of their dignity about them. She left them to it. She had killed 3 captains already, not counting Karkaroth, as well as 2 Archons, and 2x that number of petty corsairs and true-born aesthetes. Some, like Karkaroth, had attempted to kill her. Others had insulted Sliskus, either to his face or behind his back. At least one had committed the ultimate sin of choosing an outfit vaguely reminiscent of the one the Duke had worn that day. All of them had died. Some by poison, others by the blade, one by the weapons of his own crew. The role of executioner was just one of the responsibilities Sliskus had foisted on her since their arrival. To her had fallen the task of organizing the camp and making the Mong Key dwellings fit for purpose. She had arranged for the dozens of disparate hunting parties to stay in some sort of contact despite the storm's interference. She watched as slaves bearing platters of food and drink circulated among the laughing corsairs. Despite the wind and the snow, the Dark Eldar were enjoying themselves. The smell of blood was on the air, and prey was plentiful. She turned away from their laughter and went to where the Slith were butchering the Duke's kill. Myrta looked down at the beast in annoyance. If that was the best this world could muster, she was doomed to disappointment.
You were hoping it would kill him?
Myrta turned. Malice stood behind her. The Archon gestured with her fan.
Do not deny it, courtesan. I saw the eagerness on your face as the beast lunged for his throat. The others may have been watching the battle, but I was watching you.
Myrta tapped the pommel of her blade.
And what of it?
She said petulantly.
He knows I wish him dead, so if you seek to hold your suspicion over me, you are sadly out of luck, my lady.
Malice clicked her tongue.
Your sisterhood has ever prided itself on its wisdom, yet in matters such as this you are as children. Sliskus is no low Camorra Archon with a paltry cabal and reach exceeding his grasp. He is called the Serpent for good reason. He is amoral, despicable, and impeccably dressed. If Vect himself could not kill him, then what hope has this world?
Myrta frowned.
Then what would you suggest?
Malice laughed.
Suggest? Nothing.
There is no hope for you. Accept your fate, or dive into the wolf's jaws if it displeases you so. Myrta's hand fell to the hilt of her blade. She yearned to draw it and show Malice the extent of her displeasure. But something in the Archon's expression stopped her.
You misunderstand me, courtesan, Malice continued quietly. I mock you, true, but not out of cruelty, merely to point out the flaws in your scheme.
She chuckled.
Indeed, I will help you, if you will let me. I thought you wanted him alive,
Myrta said.
I want him in my debt, Malice corrected. He listens to you as he will not listen to others. He does so because he thinks he has nothing to fear from you. He knows your secret desire, and it makes him arrogant.
So I will help you humble him.
But not kill him.
Why kill what can be useful? Malice smiled. She looked down at the dead creature. No. You do not want such a beast dead, my dear. You want him tamed.
Chapter 13. Rousing the Pack. 641.M41. The tunnel was a tight fit, especially given their burdens.
"This isn't how I imagined we would be doing this," Halvar said, as he adjusted the weight of the Miod cask hanging from his back, just beneath his battle plate's power pack.
Rather than delicious amber liquid, it contained the broken body of one of their foes. Lucas thought forlornly of the last dregs of Miod sloshing at the bottom of the cask, now never to be drunk, but only briefly. Some things were too painful to consider.
They're not likely to let us in without an argument, and time is of the essence.
He had his own cask, filled with a similar weight of dead meat. Lucas patted it, causing it to gurgle unpleasantly.
Besides, it keeps them from stinking too badly. We're pickling them. We could have drunk that. At least we're not eating them afterwards.
Lucas's expression became speculative.
Though we could, I suppose.
No.
Seems a waste to burn them, is all.
No.
Where is your sense of adventure, Halvar? Lucas asked. New experiences are what life is all about. Not our lives. I just kill Xenos. I don't eat them.
Halvar hesitated.
Except orc, on occasion. Very rare occasions,
he added hastily.
No need to be ashamed, pup. We've all eaten an orc at one time or another. They cook up nicely.
Lucas concentrated on navigating the narrow, uneven corridor. It was a natural borehole worn open by tectonic pressures, weather, or some long-ago disaster. One of the secret paths that wolves and other things use to sneak into the Ett. This one wound its way into the refectories. Using the front gate had been ruled right out. Grimblood and the other Jarls needed to be alerted to the presence of the Xenos on Fenris, but they wouldn't be inclined to listen. Not that he could blame them. The tunnel abruptly came to a dead end, a thin circle of light marking the rough-hewn wall. Lucas pressed himself against the rock face, his hands moving slowly.
When I found this tunnel, I spent some time making sure no one else could do so, he said.
Unseen tumblers clicked, and the rock face shuddered. The circle of light expanded, the rock hissing. Lucas lifted part of the wall up and away. The heat of the refectory washed over them as they stepped out of the tunnel. Lucas breathed in, tasting the mingled aromas of cooking meat and off-world spices. While meat was often roasted over the great fire pits that marked the heart of every gathering chamber, that was more for show than anything else. The bulk of every meal was made in the refectories by the sure hands of trusted bondsmen. Few of his kind came down here. The plethora of smells alone could easily overpower the senses of a grey hunter, let alone a bloodclaw, unless he was prepared for it. Heat blasted from open ovens, and the air throbbed with the noise of culinary industry, the thunk of knives, the rattle of pans, the sound of hundreds of voices raised in effort. There were servants for whom these refectories were the entirety of their world. The flames of the ovens were the sun, while the waters pumped up from the icy flows below the fang and poured into the storage butts were the oceans. Lobotomized machine thralls trundled through the maze of preparation slabs, hunched beneath industrial serving trays. Lucas hefted the section of wall back into place, using cleverly carved crannies in the rock. It snapped into position with a grinding sound. Lucas stepped back and nodded.
There, he murmured. And how many of those do you have secreted about?
Halvar asked. Lucas laughed.
Ha ha! More than one!
He gestured.
Come on, this way.
They navigated the maze of preparation slabs, moving quickly. But just before they reached the doors, a woman's voice called out.
You're not supposed to be here, my lords.
Lucas froze. He turned, a sheepish look on his face. The woman was tall for an unaugmented human, with the pallor of one who had never seen the sun. She had silver hair pulled tight over high-boned features, and the faint blue of faded tattoos curled down one side of her face and neck. She glowered up at the two warriors, as if they were nothing more than over-large scullions. Lucas grinned weakly.
Burla! How fortuitous!
Burla had been comely in her youth. She was still comely, though his appreciation was more aesthetic than primal. There was a strange sort of beauty to unaugmented humans. They grew more interesting the older they became, unlike the Vulka Fenrika, who all grew to resemble wolves, or worse, the same wolf. Their gene sire had a shadow that stretched over millennia, and the generations that rose and fell within them. But there was a variety to the mortals that never failed to fascinate him. He stepped towards her, ignoring the servants who scuttled fearfully from his path. She didn't retreat. She had grown to womanhood in the kitchens, as had her mother and grandmother, unto 7 generations. An unbroken line of hearth mistresses whose word in the refectories was law.
My lord, she said, it has been many cycles since you last visited my kitchens. To what do we owe the honour?
Just passing through, I assure you, he said, looming over her.
What is that?
Burla asked, pointing at the cask on Lucas's back. There was precious little respect in her tone. Any other space wolf might have killed her out of hand for the insult. But she knew Lucas of old, and knew that he rarely took insult, even where it was damn well intended. Lucas stepped back, giving her space.
What is what?